Imagine a territory that makes up nearly half of our entire planet.
Yeah, it's a massive scale.
Right. A vast, essentially lawless frontier, just existing completely beyond the borders of any single country. For a very long time, this massive expanse has been treated as, out of sight and out of mind.
Exactly, like an infinite resource.
Yeah, infinite resource that no one entity is actually responsible for protecting. Welcome to the high seas. We are so glad you are joining us for this deep dive into the ultimate global commons.
And I mean, the sheer scale of this area almost defies human comprehension. When a territory belongs to everyone, it often functionally belongs to no one.
Which is a huge problem.
Oh, absolutely. It makes any attempt to govern it an incredible geopolitical challenge.
And governing it is exactly what we are unpacking today, because to figure out how the international community is finally attempting to reel in this chaotic space, we are pulling from a really fascinating stack of source material today.
Yeah, some really groundbreaking stuff.
Our main guide is a 2024 academic comment, and it was published in NPJ Climate Action, authored by researchers MD Saiful Karim and William W.L. Chung.
Right, and their analysis looks at a very recent, honestly, intensely historic piece of international law.
Which is pretty rare, right?
Yeah, very. It is formally called the Agreement on Biodiversity Beyond National Jurisdiction, but we'll just call it the BBNJ agreement for short.
That is a lot easier to say. So, our mission for today's deep dive is to explore how this brand new, landmark United Nations Biodiversity Treaty is basically secretly doubling as a powerful weapon for global climate action.
It really is doing double duty.
Okay, let's unpack this, because before we get into the new rules of the BBNJ agreement, we have to look at the old, broken rules that it's trying to fix, right?
We do. We're talking about the 1982 United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea.
Right, UNCLOS.
Yeah, UNCLOS. And UNCLOS was considered a monumental achievement back in the early 1980s.
Because it created some baseline rules.
Exactly. It created clear jurisdictions and institutions. For example, it established the International Seabed Authority to heavily regulate the mining of non-living resources on the ocean floor in international waters.
Okay, so that sounds good on paper.
It does, but it contained a massive, glaring loophole regarding the areas beyond national jurisdiction.
And this is where the distinction between living and non-living resources is where the whole thing just falls apart.
Completely falls apart.
I mean, if you wanted to scoop up minerals or metals or rocks from the deep ocean floor, UNCLOS had these really strict rules.
Very strict.
But if you were looking at the living resources, the fish, the marine mammals, the incredibly complex ecosystems floating in the water column above that highly regulated seabed, the treaty basically just established this broad freedom of fishing.
Yeah, it gave all countries the right to extract living resources on the high seas with only the most vague, incredibly weak conservation obligations attached to
It's
it.
just a free-for-all.
Basically, it created a differential treatment that essentially birthed a chaotic legal vacuum for marine biology.
It sounds like setting strict, heavily monitored rules for mining the dirt in a massive global forest, but telling everyone it's a total free-for-all if they want to hunt the animals living there.
That is a perfect way to put it.
Because you cannot just separate the dirt from the ecosystem that thrives on top of it. But I do have to push back here for a second, because lawmakers in the 1970s and 80s were smart people. Did they really just completely miss the climate threat to these living resources?
It seems crazy now, right?
Yeah. How does an international body overlook something that fundamental?
Well, what's fascinating here is that the impacts of climate change on marine biodiversity simply were not on the agenda during the UNCLOS era.
They just didn't know.
The scientific consensus regarding how carbon emissions would fundamentally alter ocean chemistry just was not part of the mainstream political dialogue yet.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, they built a legal framework for a world where the ocean seemed infinitely vast and honestly, infinitely resilient to human activity.
So we have this legal system that treats ocean life like an infinite, indestructible buffet.
Sadly, yes.
But as global carbon emissions skyrocketed over the following decades, that illusion of invincibility totally shattered.
Completely shattered.
And fixing a legal mistake of that magnitude requires getting the whole world to agree on new rules for a space where no one is technically in charge.
Which is a nightmare.
Right? And that friction leads us right into the dramatic 20-year negotiation of the new BBNJ agreement, which was, finally adopted on June 19th, 2023.
Calling it a two-decade tug of war barely captures the intensity of those rooms, honestly.
I can only imagine.
The source highlights heavily polarized viewpoints, particularly a really stark divide between developed and developing nations during this marathon negotiation.
And we are not taking sides here, just to be clear to you listening. We are just looking at the distinct, deeply ingrained priorities these different nations brought to the table.
Right, just reporting the facts of the negotiation.
Exactly. On one side, developed countries made their priority establishing robust conservation and protection measures for the oceans.
Which is great.
It is, however, they wanted these ecological protections structured in a way that would not jeopardize their existing commercial interests on the high seas.
Right. And developing nations approached the table with a very different, equally urgent set of priorities focused on equity.
Right. Totally different angle.
They took a firm stance demanding a formalized system for benefit sharing, specifically regarding the exploitation of what the treaty calls marine genetic resources, or MGRs.
Let's actually pause and look at marine genetic resources for a second, because this concept is huge.
It's massive.
We're talking about the DNA, right? The biological materials found in deep sea organisms. Think about extremophiles, these crazy organisms living around boiling hydrothermal vents in the pitch black.
Yeah, they are incredible.
And their genetic material is incredibly valuable for developing lucrative new pharmaceuticals, advanced cosmetics, or even novel enzymes for industrial processes.
Exactly. And developing nations argued that if the high seas are truly the global commons, the billions of dollars generated from those marine genetic resources shouldn't just funnel back to the handful of wealthy nations.
The ones that happen to possess the advanced submarines and biotechnology required to extract them.
Right. So they demanded financial assistance and the formal transfer of marine technology so their economies could actually participate in this emerging ocean sector.
It is a massive philosophical divide over who owns the future of the ocean.
Truly.
Yet, amidst this giant geopolitical arm wrestle, the authors of our source highlight one specific group as the unsung heroes of the final text.
The small island developing states?
Yes, the small island developing states. These nations played what the researchers actually call the vanguard role, fighting relentlessly to ensure that specific climate action elements were woven into the final biodiversity agreement.
And the inclusion of those climate elements is vital. While it is certainly a triumph that these negotiations concluded with a positive outcome.
I mean, getting everyone to agree is huge.
It is, but a 20-year history of friction is a flashing warning sign. It heavily foreshadows the immense complexity of actually implementing this agreement globally.
Yeah.
If it took two decades just to agree on the vocabulary, enforcing those words across half the globe is going to be a monumental logistical challenge.
That is so true, and this brings up a crucial question. Why did the small island nations fight so incredibly hard to force climate action into what was supposed to be just a biodiversity treaty?
A great question.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Because on the surface, protecting sea turtles from overfishing seems totally different from reducing CO2 in the atmosphere. Why mix them into one highly contentious legal document?
Well, the answer lies in the findings of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or the IPCC.
Right.
Their sixth assessment report, which our source draws on heavily, proves you physically cannot separate the two.
They're completely intertwined.
Completely. Human-driven CO2 emissions don't just sit in the sky. The ocean acts as a massive thermal and chemical sponge for our pollution.
And the mechanics of that sponge effect are actually terrifying when you dig into the IPCC data.
Very terrifying.
First, the ocean absorbs a massive percentage of the excess heat trapped by greenhouse gases,
right,
which leads to rapid ocean warming.
Right.
And warmer water fundamentally holds less dissolved oxygen, which creates widespread deoxygenation. You're basically suffocating marine life.
Yeah. And beyond the heat, the ocean absorbs an enormous portion of the actual CO2 gas itself.
Right, the actual gas.
When carbon dioxide mixes with seawater, it creates carbonic acid, dropping the pH of the water in a process known as ocean acidification.
Oh, man. I was reading about how ocean acidification actively dissolves the calcium carbonate shells of tiny organisms like sea butterflies.
Yeah, it literally dissolves them while they are alive.
So the water is getting hotter, it is losing oxygen, and it is becoming corrosive to the base of the food chain.
Exactly. And the IPCC notes these combined stressors trigger massive shifts in species distribution.
Like fish literally fleeing.
Yes. Fish populations are literally fleeing toward the poles in search of cooler waters. It alters their body sizes, it disrupts the timing of biological events like spawning, and it fractures entire food webs.
That is bleak.
And that is just the baseline reality, even before factoring in marine heat waves, which cause sudden, devastating mass mortality events, wiping out local populations in a matter of weeks.
Wow. So the climate is actively dismantling the ocean's biodiversity. But the source points out a critical reciprocal relationship, right? Which works the other way, too.
Yes. This is so important.
Healthy marine biodiversity is actually the engine that drives global carbon sequestration and storage.
Precisely. This is a concept known as the biological pump.
Biological pump, okay.
Yeah, so plankton at the surface absorb carbon dioxide through photosynthesis.
Just like plants on land.
Exactly. And those plankton are eaten by small fish, which are then eaten by larger predators like tuna or whales.
Okay, falling.
When those organisms produce waste, or when they die, that carbon-rich organic matter sinks into the deep sea, which is sometimes called marine snow.
Marine snow. That's a beautiful term for something so functional. So it basically locks that carbon away in the deep ocean for centuries or even millennia.
Yes, totally removes it from the atmosphere.
And without that thriving, diverse food web, the biological pump shuts down, leaving all that carbon in the atmosphere to accelerate global warming.
Right. It would be a disaster.
So if you were sitting in a landlocked city right now, just experiencing a normal summer instead of a catastrophic heat wave, you literally have the high seas biological pump to thank.
You really do.
You cannot have climate mitigation without biodiversity conservation. They're the exact same battle.
And recognizing that they are the same battle completely changes the legal approach. The authors of our source point out that no previous global ocean-related legal instrument explicitly addresses climate change with this level of integration.
It's a total paradigm shift.
It is. Right from the opening lines, you know, the preamble of the BBNJ agreement explicitly recognizes the loss of biological diversity due to climate change impacts.
It names the threat outright instead of ignoring it.
Exactly.
And then it backs up that preamble with very specific legal teeth. Like, look at Article 7.
Oh, Article 7 is huge.
Our source notes this article mandates states to build ecosystem resilience and specifically maintain the carbon cycling services that underpin the ocean's role in the climate.
Right.
It literally takes the science of the biological pump we just discussed and turns it into a binding legal obligation.
And the operational teeth get even sharper in Article 17, which establishes area-based management tools.
Area-based management tools. What does that actually mean in practice?
Well, this is arguably the most powerful mechanism in the entire treaty because it creates a formal legal mandate to establish marine protected areas, or MPAs, directly on the high seas.
Because before this, trying to protect a patch of international water was just a jurisdictional nightmare.
Exactly. Nobody could agree who had the authority.
But thinking about MPAs on the high seas, it sounds less like tossing a random safety net over a patch of water and more like creating biological corridors.
I like that, biological corridors.
Yeah, because if we connect these new high seas protected areas with the existing marine sanctuaries that countries already have in their own coastal waters, we could build a transoceanic network,
right?
Like stepping stones across the ocean.
That is a great way to visualize it. These networks act as fortresses of climate resilience. By eliminating the compounding stress of industrial fishing or prospective deep sea mining in these zones, you basically give the ecosystem a fighting chance to adapt to the warming, acidifying waters.
Just giving them some breathing room. And the treaty also implements a massive hurdle for any new commercial activities through Part 4, right?
Yes, Part 4 is critical. It mandates rigorous environmental impact assessments, or EIAs.
So if a nation or a corporation wants to plan a new activity in international waters, they must undergo this assessment.
Right.
And Article 1 legally requires state parties to consider the cumulative impacts of their actions.
The inclusion of that single word, cumulative, fundamentally shifts the burden of proof.
Because it prevents a corporation from saying, well, our single deep sea mining operation won't do much harm on its own.
Exactly.
Under this agreement, they have to specifically factor in the existing background consequences of climate change and ocean acidification. They have to prove their new activity won't be the final stressor that causes an already heat-stressed ecosystem to collapse.
Right. If we connect this to the broader geopolitical picture, The BBNJ agreement removes decades of complex legal barriers,
which were holding everything back.
Yeah. Regional organizations previously had their hands tied when trying to enforce broad conservation rules in international waters. Now they have a strict, undeniable legal mandate from the United Nations to act proactively.
And we are actually seeing the ripple effects of this already, aren't we?
We are, yeah.
The source mentions a recent resolution passed by the Indian Ocean Tuna Commission. They officially integrated climate change perspectives into their fisheries management framework.
Which is a huge deal.
Yeah. It is a very tangible, early example of regional bodies utilizing this new legal landscape to adapt their strategies.
It is a phenomenal step. But having a beautifully drafted legal document in a UN headquarters is vastly different from forcing behavioral change out on the open water.
That's the catch, isn't it?
Yeah. We have to confront the stark reality of how this agreement actually gets implemented.
So what does this all mean for the immediate future? Because according to our source, this incredibly powerful treaty is not actually in effect yet.
No, it's not.
It requires formal ratification from at least 60 different parties. That means 60 individual national governments have to take this treaty home, debate it in their parliaments, navigate their own domestic politics, and pass it into their own national law.
And that domestic legislative process consumes time. Time that the ocean ecosystem simply does not have to spare.
Not at all.
The authors of the comment explicitly warn that the clock of climate action is rapidly ticking to prevent catastrophic tipping points.
If it takes 5, 10, or 15 years to hit that 60-party threshold, the very biological pumps and ecosystems this treaty was designed to protect might already be pushed past the point of no return.
Exactly.
The entire purpose of this monumental agreement could be totally defeated by bureaucratic friction.
And even after it inevitably crosses that 60-party threshold, the international community is forced to confront the chronic problem of international environmental law.
Which is?
Well, many of these treaties end up being entirely toothless in practice because they lack enforcement mechanisms or funding.
Right. And the source points to a deeply troubling historical precedent here. The Marine Technology Transfer Framework, built into the original 1982 UN-SILOS Agreement, the mechanism specifically designed to help developing nations, largely failed.
Yeah, it was a massive failure.
It remains one of the most highly ignored, unfulfilled promises of that entire convention.
And this brings us right back to the urgent demands made by developing nations during the 20-year BBNJ negotiation.
It's all connected.
It is fundamentally a question of global equity and practical logistics. You cannot demand that a developing nation with limited infrastructure suddenly enforce complex, cumulative environmental impact assessments or police massive marine protected areas in the deep ocean without supplying them with the advanced technology and the financial backing to actually execute those tasks.
Right. The source makes it crystal clear. Without strict technological and financial investment from wealthier countries, developing ocean-dependent regions across Africa, Asia, and the South Pacific will find it absolutely impossible to implement these climate actions.
It just won't happen.
And if that financial and technological transfer fails again, the way it did in the 80s, it dooms the entire global effort. The ocean's currents are completely interconnected. You cannot just protect the half of the high seas adjacent to wealthy nations and expect the planetary biological pump to survive.
Exactly. The legal architecture is finally in place, but without widespread, genuine participation and heavily funded international cooperation, it will remain just aspirational words on a page.
Pulling all of these threads together, this deep dive reveals that the BBNJ agreement is far more than a niche treaty designed to save a few species of fish.
Much more.
It is a revolutionary legal framework that finally forces the world to acknowledge the scientific reality of the IPCC reports. It legally mandates that we treat ocean health and climate action as the exact same global priority, deploying tools like high seas marine protected areas and rigorous cumulative environmental impact assessments to defend the global commons.
It really provides a very real reason for cautious optimism. But this raises an important question, one inspired by the source's brief mention of climate-driven range shifts in transboundary fish stocks.
Okay, lay it on us.
Well, we discussed how the oceans are warming rapidly and how marine species are physically migrating toward the poles to find cooler water and survive.
Right, the entire map of marine life is constantly on the move.
So if the very ecosystems, the marine genetic resources, and the fish stocks this treaty aims to protect are literally moving across invisible national borders and high seas boundaries, how will static, slow-moving international laws adapt to a dynamic, shifting map beneath the waves?
Wow. That is a staggering puzzle. Law requires rigid boundaries, but nature is entirely fluid. How do you govern a protected area when the ecosystem you are trying to protect is literally swimming away from it?
Exactly.
That is something for you to mull over as you go about your day. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the unseen frameworks that govern our planet, especially out there in the vast, wild territory of the high seas.